You're listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. Hi, I'm so glad that you are listening today. I have a great show for you today with Dr. Norman Deutsch. If this is your first time listening, please sign up for the newsletter, and that way I can let you know when podcast episodes air. They're free. You can listen to them any time of day or night from the show page at zentertainment.org. And you can also download episodes. So make sure to do that in case you want to listen to it later, because I do archive episodes eventually. So Dr. Norman Deutsch, he wrote this great book called The Brain That Changes Itself. I know many of you read that before. I love this book, and I hope that if you haven't read it, you'll go out and get it. His follow-up to that is the new book called The Brain's Way of Healing. It's on sale now, and this extends the reach of neuroplastic treatments. We've been talking a lot about neuroplasticity and how we can use it to change our brains, our bodies, change our lives. So this book provides new hope for people who suffer from many kinds of things such as chronic pain, Parkinson's, strokes, attention deficit disorders, autism, MS, traumatic brain injuries, sensory processing disorders, and more. So I recommend it, and I hope you enjoy this interview. There's some great information for you, and that's why I'm also offering a longer interview today. He was kind enough to do that for us. You can find out more at normandeutsch.com. So I want to welcome him to the show today. How would you define neuroplasticity? We hear a lot of definitions. What's your definition of it?
Neuro is for neuron, or the nerve cells in the nervous system, but particularly the brain. Those are the ones that are of most interest right now. Plasticity means changeable, adaptable, or modifiable. And neuroplasticity is that property of the brain that allows it to change its structure and its function in response to activity, what we do, and mental experience, broadly understood. So thinking can change brain structure and function. Imagining, perceiving, sensing, having emotional experiences. We now know that they all can change brain structure and function. And it's a revolutionary discovery, because the earlier models of the brain didn't see the circuitry as changeable. It was seen to be as like an electrical machine. We still have the term circuit with us. That's part of that metaphor of the brain as an electrical machine. And the circuitry was seen to be hardwired, which meant formed and finalized in childhood. And that meant that if you were born with cerebral palsy or a learning disorder, there was nothing you could do to change it. You'd learn to work around it. And if you had a brain disease or a brain injury, again, nothing you could do about it. And if your brain was beginning to fail, it was seen to be like a machine that was wearing out. And machines are use it and lose it. Mm-hmm. But what plasticity shows is, although, you know, in the end we, of course, all die, and brain function gets compromised, in certain decisive respects, your brain is far more likely to waste away from underuse than wear out from overuse. And there are ways you can, you know, live your life and use your brain that can actually even improve it from where you are. So that if you're, I don't know, 50 years old, and it's your memory has been going down, there are ways you can make it function as well as it did when you were 40. Everything we do engages brain plasticity. But in general, let me go back to just the brain structure and explain it this way. There's a part of the brain called the nucleus basalis, and the nucleus basalis is involved in engaging attention and helping make it easy, when you pay attention to something that's new and interesting, to form new connections in your brain and consolidate them. Mm-hmm. If the nucleus basalis is turned on, you can learn without any effort. And it's actually turned on in infants and young children. That's why kids, and infants in particular, are interested in everything. They're always paying attention. You make a funny face, they pay attention. You tickle them, they pay attention. You throw new words at them, and they pick up, you know, new words every day without effort. They don't furrow their brow. The nucleus basalis is turned on, and we say they're going through critical periods of plasticity, when plastic change is easier. Once we've learned, let's say, the mother tongue, and get to be a certain age, usually around adolescence, that nucleus basalis for the language areas of the brain can only be turned, it's no longer automatically on. It can be only turned on when you make an effortful, when you pay attention, when you make a mental effort to pay attention. Uh-huh. You have to furrow your brow to learn a new language at that point. Mm. Now, as we get older, we stop doing the kinds of intensive brain workouts that engage the nucleus basalis. So let's say you're in high school and you're learning a foreign language. Well, that's, you pay effortful attention and you engage the nucleus basalis, and you keep the nucleus basalis very fit. But as you hit middle age, say, what you do most of the time is nowhere near as demanding as what you did right. in brain terms when you were learning a Latin or a Spanish or French vocabulary
right.
or whatever.
Right.
And what most of us do in middle age, there's a little bit less of this now, but in general, we replay mastered skills. We're not learning a new language. We might be speaking one we've already learned. Mm-hmm. We're usually in the same career, although some people are doing career changes, mm-hmm. of course, but we may be married to the same person, or not. But if we're really neurotic, we may have just remarried the person we just left with a different hair color. So the replay of mastered skills is actually very problematic for the brain, because it's like never giving your brain a workout. And, you get to be 40 and you go to a party and someone introduces you to someone, and then you're sure you'll remember it. And you realize, I forgot it. And then by the time you're 50, you know you have a problem with this, mm-hmm. and you pay special attention to remember it, and you forget it. Mm-hmm. And this isn't necessarily a sign of Alzheimer's or dementia. It's usually a sign of what is called in the literature age-related cognitive decline. And it's just totally a function of not engaging the brain enough. So the first thing is, this is where serious brain exercises come in. They can really help you engage the brain. And people are all, it's always the next question, which ones do you think are serious? To my knowledge, having studied the history of plasticity, I followed the work of Dr. Michael Merzenich.
Yeah.
Most closely, because he did decisive experiments that proved the brain was plastic. And I spent years working with neuroscientists, and they developed something called Brain HQ. And Brain HQ has, been studied in 100 serious studies. I mean, I'm talking, at major universities and so on. And a recent study by the National Institute of Health showed that people who did Brain HQ 10 years ago still have some benefits from their period doing it. And the benefits generalize to everyday life. And they're being studied to work with people who've had traumatic brain injuries and a number of, in very serious places. So uh-huh. I like that one, and it's very incremental. The second thing is very low. So that's you do on your computer at home. The second thing is very low tech, but really, really important, and that's physical exercise. And it doesn't have to be brutal. Uh-huh. A recent study, just a year ago, and the most important study that's ever been done on the relationship of exercise and warding off dementia. So this is lowering your risk of getting dementia. Showed that 5 healthy activities, if you did 4 of the 5, led to a decreased risk of getting dementia, including Alzheimer's and vascular dementia, the 2 most common kinds, by a staggering 60%.
And what are those things?
But I just want to say before I say what they are, can you imagine if there was a drug that did that?
Right.
It would be the most talked about drug on the planet.
Yeah, front page news. Right.
Every day and every cocktail party and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That study got some attention, but not nearly the attention it deserves, because we anticipate that the help for this is going to come from some very high-tech, multi-gazillion dollar investment. Mm-hmm. When you hear the 5 things, you'll understand why they work. The first and most important one and most potent one was exercise. The study was done by the Cochrane Institute, a very, very serious group. Physicians listening will know that the Cochrane reviews are the gold standard in tests. And they followed almost 2,300 men in Wales from one town for 30 years. And exercise was defined as walking at least 2 miles a day. So a lot of the men walked a mile to work and back. Mm-hmm. That was good enough. Or riding a bike 5 days a week for a total of 10 miles. Or any regular vigorous exercise. The second most important factor was not smoking, which messes up your blood vessels in your brain and has all sorts of toxins. Mm-hmm. And then there was being a normal weight, which was measured as a BMI from 18 to just under 25. Mm-hmm. Eating lots of fruits and vegetables, I think it was 4 to 5 servings a day. Uh-huh. And that wasn't, it may not even be that the fruits and vegetables are what does it, but that was a marker for men who actually paid attention to what they ate. Yeah. In a location where dietary habits were pretty poor in general. It may have been meant that they're eating a lot of stuff that's not processed, for instance, mm-hmm. and getting the fruits and vegetables. And then low to moderate drinking, about a glass of wine a day. Now, that is not a recommendation that anyone has a glass of wine a day. It just meant that the men who were having more than that, that did not correlate with decreasing the risk of dementia.
That's really interesting.
But, you know, those are the low-tech things. But the essence of my book, which is called The Brain's Way of Healing, are all sorts of new ways of helping and healing the brain that are non-invasive, that don't involve cracking open skulls or taking medication. And basically, what I found in a very careful review of many different illnesses was that when there is a brain problem, yeah. let's say a person, for instance, has a stroke and loses the use of their right leg. In the past, what people would assume is this. If the person lost 90% of the use of their right leg, they assumed that 90% of the neurons that governed the movement of the right leg were dead, or that the tracks coming from those neurons weren't working. That is not what I believe happens in the brain. They assumed that because there was a tendency to describe neurons as either on or off.
Right.
But what really happens is the only time neurons are completely off is when they are dead. Normally, when they're in the so-called off position, they're firing infrequently, infrequent signals, and they are doing some processing. And then when they're in the on position, they fire faster. And so when the brain is damaged by any number of diseases, mm-hmm. Parkinson's, MS, aging, learning disorders, multiple sclerosis, traumatic brain injury, I could go on and on.
Right.
What happens is some cells are dead, some are firing at irregular rates, so they're not able to perform their functions, and they're giving signals to healthy cells that are getting lousy input. I call that the noisy brain. And what you can do with these interventions that I describe is you can synchronize the brain non-invasively, taking advantage of the following thing, that the brain works by firing patterns of information, and many of our senses actually simply do the following. They take patterns of information in the outside world, let's say human speech or sound in music, and they translate it into patterns of electrical firing. Now, if you've ever been driving down the road and a car pulls up and it's got a really loud bass beat,
yeah, that loud
that you
boom.
Can hear, uh-huh. you feel uncomfortable and roll up your window. Uh-huh. If you were to do an EEG of your neurons are firing at the same rate as that beat. That's how permeable we are. Our uh-huh. neurons are entrained to that sound. If you're prone to epilepsy and you watch a strobe light, your brain will start firing in an epileptic fit, in sync with those lights. Now, what the treatments I describe do is they use this to talk to the brain in its own language to drive it in a healthier direction and resynchronize it. So that I have stories about people using sound to improve learning disorders, autism, ADD, or light to improve traumatic brain injury. These are all non-invasive.
I love that there's so many non-invasive things we can do, everything from gratitude to appreciation to visualization. In studying neuroplasticity, a lot of people talk about the two branches of the autonomic nervous system, and there's a lot of focus on the fight or flight. And I'm wondering, In your book, there's a lot of things that they're not always dealing with fight or flight. So is neuroplasticity always about fight or flight? Is that involved in every
condition?
No, not at all. Not at all.
No, I mean, there are several branches to the autonomic nervous system. One of them puts us into fight or flight. Another one, the parasympathetic, turns that off.
Right.
But it does much more than turning off the fight or flight system. It also turns on. It's also involved in rest, digestion, immune function, improved immune function. That's why things like meditation and things are so important. Mm-hmm. The other thing it's involved with that people don't usually link to the parasympathetic system is it's involved in social engagement with other people. Mm-hmm. So it's the parasympathetic system. You can't engage with other people when you're in fight or flight. You're just trying to survive. But we see this with our treatments that I described for autism or ADD. When the children get calm and focused with the proper kinds of modified music to quiet the noisy brain, they start to connect. They start to, the parasympathetic system actually turns on nerves involved in hearing human speech. Most people don't know this. Uh-huh. And the nerves involved in vocal expression and eye contact. So when a kid goes out of fight or flight, their whole face changes and they're more ready to engage socially. And this is really important in something like autism. I think the autistic children don't engage socially because they're hypersensitive to sound.
Right.
Because of a noisy brain. And so their brain is in perpetual fight or flight because of these sensitivities.
Yeah.
And you can't engage in that condition.
A lot of research I've read claims that many children with autism have an inflamed gut. And I'm wondering if someone can have an unhealthy digestive system and also have a healthy brain. And the second part of that question is the brain the master controller? Is the brain where all the action is?
Sure. Well, let's start off with the gut issue. I don't know for sure, but I doubt that you can have a healthy gut and a completely healthy gut and a completely healthy brain.
You mean an unhealthy gut and a healthy brain.
I doubt you can have an unhealthy gut and a completely healthy brain. We're not machines which are sort of designed for a single purpose. And parts are made that are separate and kind of like brought together. That's not how it works. We're organisms. And all of our parts evolve together and support each other together. And they're pretty much all necessary. Yes, you can get by without a few toes and so on and so forth. But it's not as though that'll have no implications for the rest of the body. But when you're talking about something as important as the gut, which is, one of the main ways in which we interface with not only the world but all the organisms that we carry. For every Joe cell, there are 10 that you have. There are 10 bacteria or 10 other little organisms.
It's kind of
and they're not
a picture. I'm not sure if I want a picture.
Yes, and they're not just guests. They're sort of co-working with you. We evolved to in a world where there were other creatures and they perform functions, they help us digest, etc. And when they're unhealthy, they have a major impact on our ability to detoxify, absorb nutrients. They often lead to a breakdown of the barrier between the gut and the outside world, so we get what's called a leaky gut. And this has an immediate impact on the brain. If we're chronically inflamed and antibodies are circulating throughout our bodies, they're not just confined immediately to the area where they were produced to deal with a problem, but they tend to float through the body and so on.
It's really about healing the whole body, isn't it? Instead of all this dividing up of ourselves, compartmentalizing.
To say that autism is a brain disease, which is the way people talk about it most of the time, is simply incorrect. Autism is a whole body disease, which also affects the brain. Mm-hmm. Autistic kids have high rates of gastrointestinal distress and inflammation, they tend to have skin problems. They tend to have many, many different problems throughout their bodies. And the parents of autistic children notice this at times more than their psychiatrists, because, you know, for the psychiatrist, that's not my department. But for the parent, you know, mothers or fathers, the whole child, and they would have to take the child around to get all these other ailments treated. So, the answer is unhealthy gut very likely has impact on the brain. And by the way, that's for a huge number of disorders. It's not just for autism. I mean, we're seeing that there's high levels of inflammation in the brain in a number of disorders now.
Can you correct this by changing your thoughts? Is that enough?
No. You know, a lot of the gut problems are arising because of the, I don't even want to say overuse of antibiotics, because that underestimates it. It's almost the, mm-hmm. I mean, when you have a situation where antibiotics are used in, from cradle to grave in the animals that we eat.
Right.
And then used very, very liberally, not in emergency situations, but very, very liberally in children. So, you know, children may get, I don't know, ear infections and have five or six of them, bang, 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 and you know that those antibiotics destroy the normal gut flora.
Yeah.
This is not something you can just correct by wishing it away or doing mental practice. I'm one of the biggest believers in the power of mental practice, but no, you have to address that at a gut level.
What are some neuroplasticity tools, I got asked this question to ask you, that people can use to help heal themselves from anxiety disorders?
Well, just the first thing is, like many, many things in biology and medicine, there's many different causes. Even the phrase anxiety disorder, which is a common phrase, is not unproblematic. You know, human beings have been experiencing anxiety since the beginning
forever.
Of time, and it is often protective. Calling it a disorder is saying, well, I'm experiencing too much of it. And many things can lead to that problem. I mean, you can have some physical illnesses which can make you feel jittery. So in medicine, I'm just going back to the way it ought to be practiced. Mm-hmm. You always have to distinguish three different levels. The first level is the symptom level, you know, what the patient is experiencing. And anxiety is a symptom. Then you have to look at organ pathology. Is there something wrong in the heart or the lungs, etc.? And then you have to go underneath that and look at pathogenesis. If there's something wrong in the organ, what's causing it? Now, when most people talk about anxiety disorders, they're basically saying, I'm anxious too much of the time, too long, for too little a reason. Mm-hmm. And you can try to approach it in a top-down way, which I described in my first book, The Brain That Changes Itself, for people who are ruminative worriers and have OCD, mm-hmm. and realize that, you know, many of the things that you're worrying about are reasonable, but the problem is, once you've done the worrying, you can't stop. So the person with OCD, I don't know, they say something they shouldn't have said to their boss, and then they have that mistake feeling. And then they say, well, okay, I'll just rectify it with him tomorrow and explain what I really meant, or that I didn't mean to say that or something, or apologize. And then what will happen is there's a switch in the brain that will turn off and say, okay, you've got a plan. Fine. But in the person with OCD, and we know this, by the way, from brain scans, that the circuit, the part of the circuit that switches you and puts you onto the next page and says, okay, you've settled that, you've got a plan, mm-hmm. now go on to something else, that gets stuck. And once you realize that you've got a kind of sticky switch in your brain, mm-hmm. you can use the fact that you realize that to say to yourself, you know, I have a problem now, but it's not with my boss, it's with my sticky switch. And then you actually have to kind of force yourself to do something wholesome. Mm-hmm. And it's what counts is not the success, but the effort. So let's say I'm going to go do gardening now. And every time something about my boss pops into my head, I'm just going to realize my problem is not with my boss. My real problem is that I've got this sticky switch, and I've got to train a kind of manual gear shift. Now, that's just one way I describe, in much more detail, by the way, in the book.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But there are other reasons people have anxiety. Very frequently, people have anxiety because of the kinds of things that Freud discovered, that the current event is triggering something that we've experienced before that's been extremely upsetting to us, perhaps even traumatic. And it's resonating with that unworked through memory of that earlier trauma. And you have to kind of make that memory of what it's really bothering you conscious. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just play with this now. So you said that thing to your boss. You were a little bit truthful, but it reminds you of a time that, I don't know, you spoke up to a teacher, and then the teacher pulled down your pants and strapped you in front of everyone in the class, or a family member did that, and so on. You know, this is a transference of a past event onto the present, and what you have to do in that, what's called for there is not so much neuroplastic as is insight into how this event parallels the earlier event, and then you can realize, oh, well, that earlier trauma is not happening now. That's why I'm sensitive. Oh, that's why I'm reacting so much. Neurons that fire together wire together. Mm-hmm. The problem with the worry circuit in the brain, and that's a neuroplastic law. Mm-hmm. The problem with the worry circuit in the brain is worries beget worries. The way I look at it is this. You know those big forests in California that if they don't get some rain for a long, long period of time, all you need to do is throw one match from your campfire astray, and then half of California is ablaze.
Yeah.
Something like that can happen in the brain. If you have a baseline level of constant worrying, you kind of get really good at worrying. You're in the mode where your brain is saying, watch out, be hyper alert, and so on. And then when something happens that is actually worth worrying about a little bit, it just sets one of these huge blazes going. And so you have to realize, you have to be monitoring your ongoing baseline level of hyper-alertness or worrying as well, so that when something worth worrying about comes along, you're not set ablaze. And
yeah, you know the difference. You know the difference between the two. And I love that phrase, sticky switch, because that's what you want to, switch it to the other.
And yes, you know, one of the things that meditation is great about, or Tai Chi, or any of these Eastern things where you basically try to be in the present and realize that you're just worrying, and so on and so forth, is they gradually reset your baseline. But you have to do it regularly, you know,
right.
It's 20 minutes a day.
I know, but it's been a great practice for me. I actually started it last November. I've been doing 20 to 30 minutes a day, and I just sit. I actually did it different. I picked out a Bible verse or something. I would talk, I'd pray, I focus on the verse. And then sometimes I just sit and I just listen, and in that calm space, and I just stay, you know, no matter what's going on, I just stay in that space, set the timer for 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's amazing how it changes you in unexpected ways.
We need that more than ever before, because mm-hmm. if you think about how we evolved, you know, we evolved to be in a situation where we didn't have artificial light. So at night, I mean, this is a very, very important point. You know, at night the sun would go down and most of us would therefore have to be inactive.
Huh.
Now we have artificial light. We stay up. We cut back on sleep. We have 24/7 internet contact throughout the world.
Yeah.
We, you know, in ancient times, people worked very, very hard. And if they were hunters, you know, they worked unbelievably hard in certain seasons. But then there were certain seasons when the animals weren't around that, you know, they would laze about.
Yeah.
And of course, if you think of the notion of the Sabbath, I don't care what religion you are. Mm-hmm. If you never reset your baseline and get away from work, you will soon not know what your baseline is. And your baseline will get ratcheted up more and more. And soon you'll be walking around like those people in those New York TV shows who are or police officers or doctors or lawyers who just go, 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 go mm-hmm. throughout the entire show.
Mm-hmm.
And so resetting the baseline is crucial. And again, neurons are fired together, wired together. We can get habituated to almost anything. Human beings are very resilient until they're not, by which I mean the human mind, the human brain, all of our different organ systems can work under very, very great duress. But then they do have a breaking point. And when the breaking point comes, it's very sudden. There were experiments done in the first part of the 20th century where people used took a kidney, which is supplied by an artery, the renal artery, mm-hmm. and they gradually reduced the size of the artery by clamping it down and to see how much blood was required for the kidney to function. And what they found is, you know, they cut 25% of it and the kidney was fine. It was producing urine. It was filtering. It was keeping the body from being toxic. 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%, 85%, 90%. And then they got to one number. I think it was something like 93%.
Wow.
And the animal just died. So there are these critical sort of thresholds. And when people push themselves, and they're not good at listening to their bodies and monitoring how they're feeling, they can take themselves into zones which are very dangerous. So back to the anxiety question. You really want to monitor your anxiety, not just when you're having an outbreak, but at the basal level. And keep in mind that there is, you know, there is no divinity determining, you know, how much technological contact, how often you should be hooked into your iPhone, how often you should be on the internet, and then telling you it's time to go off. Only you can monitor that. Mm-hmm. And this is getting people's nervous systems extremely jacked up.
It is, right? All the social media, and we're all on it all the time. Have you seen the TV show called Brain Games?
No.
It is just the most fascinating show I've ever seen. I think you would love it. And there's a whole series of different episodes, and it's phenomenal. And you watch, and they prove to you how you see illusions, and how you don't see what you really think you see sometimes. The last episode, well, I just started watching, and I'm behind because I hadn't heard about it, but the episode I watched yesterday was all about what we pay attention to. And how many things we miss because what we see and what we pay attention to is based on what we expect.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very much.
So fascinating. And they do all these games, too, to even show you what you're missing. Like, you think, no way, I won't miss that. Well, I just want to bring it up because I think you'll love it. And all of you listening, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It ties right into everything we're talking about.
Well, I can just relate that to some of the things I see in, you know, the book, The Brain's Way of Healing, which is there's just if our circuitry, let me talk about, for instance, how we've developed some ways of helping people, for instance, with things like stroke or various kinds of bodily problems. If a person has a stroke and there's a crisis in the brain and there's a lot of chemical chaos because a stroke's based on a bleed or a clot and you have to clear it all up, and while that's happening, the brain is so preoccupied that it can't perform its functions very well. And it's a use it or lose it brain. If you're not using certain circuitry, it starts to actually waste away. That's a very important point. It's not just that it's turned off. It starts to kind of wither over time. So if you've had some kind of brain damage of some kind or other, mm-hmm. the circuits actually go dormant. And when they're dormant, they're not reporting. They're not reporting sensation. And so you try to use it, but your feeling isn't working and you don't have good feedback. When you try to, let's say, use the limb, and it's very, very clumsy, and you can't really initiate things, the tendency of unused circuitry to go dormant is one of the central things that forms the basis of my book, The Brain's Way of Healing. Mm-hmm. Just knowing that means that what we've been able to do is discover all sorts of ways of stimulating the dormant circuitry. But when a system's turned off, you just can't use it. What magicians are doing at this, the brain games, is basically basic magic, is they have methods of distraction, methods of getting you not to use parts of your brain because right. you're using other parts of your brain. And when you use one part of the brain, it very frequently inhibits another part of the brain. Mm-hmm. That's the way the brain works. So we have two hemispheres, and they're this huge cable between the hemispheres called the corpus callosum. And most of those cables carry signals that are inhibitory, so that when you're using one part of your brain, it's turning off other parts of your brain so it can do its job. And when people have strokes, for instance, let's say a person had a stroke in the right hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Well, the right hemisphere normally, among other things, inhibits the left hemisphere in day-to-day life. That may be an unusual concept, but that's what it does.
Huh.
Now, if your right hemisphere is no longer inhibiting your left hemisphere, the right hemisphere isn't working well, but the left hemisphere has nothing to oppose it when it wants to work, and it inhibits the right hemisphere still further. So the person's had a stroke. They have less right hemisphere cortical real estate to process things. And now the left hemisphere is bullying the right hemisphere because it tends to inhibit it anyway. And one way to help the person with the stroke is actually to inhibit the left hemisphere so that you can see what the right hemisphere can do. And we can inhibit the left hemisphere with magnetic stimulation called transcranial magnetic stimulation. And you'll find, so the person's had a right hemisphere stroke, if you inhibit the left, you can actually start to see some function return from the right. This goes back to what we were talking about before. We're not a machine mm-hmm. where parts work independently. Everything relates to everything else. And so to understand the brain's way of healing in all these illnesses I describe, in Parkinson's and autism and ADD, and multiple sclerosis, you have to understand these core principles, and you have to understand the brain holistically, and that when you stimulate circuits, they'll turn off other circuits, but also they can begin to get better at what they do, because neurons that fire together wire together, and we can make new circuits to replace old circuits that have been damaged. That's the beauty of the living brain, as opposed to the machine-like model, which says, well, the part's been destroyed. Unless we can get a replacement part, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
But in an organism, as opposed to machine, no. Other areas can often take over.
So have you seen this to work as well for people not only with MS, but people with chronic fatigue syndrome who kind of have overlapping symptoms and causes, and that to be able to use this kind of work to
help themselves? Chronic fatigue syndrome, I'm not an expert in that, but I've seen different approaches to chronic. I think many things can give rise to chronic fatigue. I think fatigue is a symptom which is a kind of an endpoint of many potential things going
mm-hmm.
wrong,
mm-hmm.
and it can be over firing of the threat system chronically, like the amygdala. It can be immunological, I think, immunological stresses. I mean, any mm-hmm. kinds of physical, mental stresses over time that we have not been able to diagnose.
Infections, heavy metals, there's all sorts of things, and it depends on
many,
the person.
Many, many things can lead to that end stage, which we call chronic fatigue.
Yeah.
And so it always requires a doctor or a healthcare professional who's not simply going by the book, but rather is takes the attitude of a Sherlock Holmes, which is, we're just going to sort of leave no stone unturned to try to find out how you, a person who was, healthy at one point,
mm-hmm.
have gotten into this stage
mm-hmm.
Where, you can't function well. And so because there are many causes of it, I think there are many different kinds of interventions that can help. You have to get the right intervention.
Yeah. I think that's true of a lot of things. So I've seen people heal from cancer by forgiving somebody. You know what I mean? I've seen people heal from Parkinson's by detoxing mercury. I've heard. So to me, it's almost like all these labels, like there can be so many overlaps. And like you said, the threat mechanism, I mean, it can be so many things. So what I love about neuroplasticity kind of as a field, you offer a lot of physical types of treatments in your book as well. You're not just talking about thoughts, behaviors. I mean, laser therapy, neuromodulation, Feldenkrais, there's so many things you go into. But there's really there's a wide range of possibilities in this field. I'm not sure of the limitations yet, but it's a really...
Well, I don't think anyone's, I think that we're just too much, we're too close to the beginning to know what the limitations for rehabilitation are. I say that quite seriously. When I say that, I'm not saying, my God, they're infinite. I mean, I doubt they're infinite. Nothing's infinite. Nothing in medicine is infinite. I mean, everyone's different and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying we simply don't know yet. Think of Michael Faraday, the person who basically discovered the laws of electromagnetism in the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe they thought after 30 years they'd exhausted what you can do with electricity, but I mean, we're still having endless patents of new, unique things that have to do with electromagnetism, and it's over 150 years later, and the same with something as important as neuroplasticity. What neuroplasticity does is it changes our understanding of the relationship of the mind and brain. Throughout the 19th and 20th century, we discovered over and over again instances where harm to the brain's structure led to changes in mental experience. A person could have a stroke, and then he could no longer distinguish his wife from a hat. A man mistook his wife for a hat. Or they'd have a stroke in one ear, in a certain part of their left hemisphere towards the front, and they can no longer form speech properly. Mm-hmm. And so on. And we learned that the brain is really, really essential in producing mental experience. And people extrapolated from that, and then they started to say, well, what is the mind? Well, the mind is nothing but or merely what the brain does.
No, that's not true.
And that was based on the idea that interference with the brain changes to alterations in mental experience. But now that we know that the brain is neuroplastic and that mental experience can also change brain structure, mm-hmm. suddenly it gets more complicated. Mm-hmm. Are we to say that the brain is merely what the mind does because the mind can change brain structure? Well, if you were to say that to a neuroscientist who's a reductionist who believes mind is nothing but what brain does, he would say, well, of course not. Or he would be very uncomfortable with that. And then he might say, well, mind is simply, he'd fall back on the explanation, mind is simply produced by the brain. So neuroplasticity is the brain changing itself, something like that, which is very close to my title. But I think, in fact, that any honest neuroscientist that I've asked to define the mind has a lot of difficulty doing it and concedes that fact. They express it in complex ways. They'll say, well, the problem of consciousness is the big unsolved problem. But that also means we don't really know how to define consciousness exactly, where it starts, where it stops, how it's made, what its boundaries are. And that's okay, because all the major problems in science, what is life, what is the universe, what is consciousness, what is the mind, all of those problems are questions that have a word in it, life, mind, universe, that we don't fully understand, which is why, of course, we're asking the question. And until we've sort of cracked the problem of what consciousness is, we cannot, strictly speaking, be certain as to whether mind is simply what the brain does, or whether it's in some way an emergent property of the brain, meaning it's something that the brain makes but then is new and has its own laws, or whether in some respects it's independent of the brain and what the brain does is not simply produce mind from scratch, but perhaps in some way or other it tunes into it. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons to wonder about that, because if you think about it, I'm right now in my home looking at a man walking across the street holding a cell phone to his ear. And it's a kind of a wintry, springy day. Uh-huh. All of that information is coming into my brain through patterns of information, light information, a little bit of sound waves too. Where is that experience? Is that experience, as we've thought recently, simply in my brain? Or is it actually part of a system where my brain is sort of tuning into that energy outside, you know, the photons, the sound waves, etc., uh-huh. and that entire system is necessary for me to be conscious? And there are some very sophisticated phenomenological, is the term I would they would use for themselves, phenomenological philosophers who think about these kinds of questions and wonder about, you know, where exactly is the location of mental experience. We thought in our reductionist period, when we said mind is nothing but what brain does, that of course it's all, quote, inside the head. But I think that's based on a confusion of perception, which is, I think, a system thing where it involves your head and what's outside of your head, and the energy between what's outside of your head coming into your head, and memory, which may be all inside your head. So maybe the perception is part of the system, and memory is going on inside your head. Anyway, you can see these are very subtle questions.
Uh-huh. And there's also the feeling we get in our gut when we see something or feel something, the feeling we get in our heart. They say the electromagnetic energy field of the heart is actually greater than that of the brain. So that's fascinating to me. What does that mean for what can heal us, how we connect, how we love? It's a huge, wonderful subject, and I'm just so grateful that you came back on the show. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you very much.
Again, for more information, you can go to the website, which is www.normandeutsch.com, and the book is The Brain's Way of Healing.